Session of the House Committee on Audits to order. And when last we met, members, we were discussing, it wasn't here, it was up at Wilson High School, we were discussing the statewide assessment system and some of the things that are going on in there. And what we're, the Audits Committee is really looking at are some of the costs. Is looking at it from the cost perspective and also looking at it from a performance measures perspective in terms of how we can make the system better or whether there would be a recommendation to, you know, potentially rid ourselves of the system or some combination in between. We do know that we've got to have, according to No Child Left Behind, we do have to have some kind of an assessment system in the state. I think the question then becomes, is there a more cost-effective way of doing this, both in terms of staff time at not only the Department of Education but also at the department at the individual school districts, and is there a more effective tool out there that measures skills and knowledge base where the students are? One of the things you'll recall that we did pick up on the other day is with regards to the math. Skills and knowledge tests, those tests had to be eliminated because they were flawed. Consequently, that's, you know, the way I look at it, that's money that's been basically poured down the drain. We will never recover that. And that's extremely unfortunate. So what I would like to do is so we're continuing this informational meeting, and this is going to be the time. The other day we were really looking at generalities from a standpoint of the Department of Education and also the opportunity to hear from real users of the system. And you'll recall we started and finished with students who have been in the system, and quite frankly they were not very complimentary. And I don't view their testimony as just being sour grapes because they don't like the outcomes. I think I view their testimony as being very real because it's something that they're looking at and they don't see how it relates and pertains to them in the future, particularly when none of our universities in the state, and there are no universities out of state that look at the SIM, that care about the SIM, or know about the SIM. Now and also the CAM, the Certificates of Initial Mastery and the Certificate of Advanced Mastery. So that's a little bit disturbing. The other thing is we heard from school board members and we heard from a variety of other folks who have been users of the system in one way or another, and they have not. They're not impressed, I guess, is probably the best way to put it. So what I'd like to do is start off with Doug Costi, and he can come back up and we can kind of start drilling down a little bit on some of the things relative to the SIM and the CAM. And also, Representative Flores, would you like to join us here at the dais? Because you are certainly welcome to. And if any other members of the Education Committee come, we will also invite them to come and join us at the dais as well. So, Mr. Doug Costi, and you'll notice that even though the pig was missing on Thursday, the pig is back. Just to remind everyone that that's the acronym PIG, and it takes change and or dollar bills very well. So, thank you. I don't know if, does anyone have any questions that they want to just fire away, or Doug, did you have something you wanted to kind of start off with?
Chair Crummell, members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Doug Costi with the Department of Education. I'm the Assistant Superintendent in charge of Assessments and Information Services. I'm I'm at your discretion in terms of if you'd like me to get into any more detail on any of these reports. I've provided the high-level overview of the data, and I believe if you'd like to and you're prepared to just start asking me some questions about the details, I believe, again, the appendices that probably will be of most interest to this group can be found in B, C, and D. And I believe the staff has made copies of these appendices to provide you additional information. So I'm happy to take those type of questions at this point.
Okay. Yes, you will remember, members, that this information was given to us the other day. There's also another copy provided for you here at the dais. Anybody have any questions they want to start off with? Just in review, Doug. When we were talking the other day, we sort of established that with regards to the assessment system in general, and particularly on the performance assessments, that really, where although Appendix C shows a total of about $5.7 million and a cost per unit of about $1,369, we really are looking at a cost of closer to $7 million, and that's because of some additional, and I'm not seeing it right here, because of some additional costs as well, and also the fact that with regards to the math system that was because it was flawed, it had to be eliminated. Would you agree then that in essence makes the unit cost go up? As opposed to what we're seeing here, you know, with the number of units we're actually able to use versus the number versus the total cost.
Chair Crummell, members of the committee, actually, I don't believe the unit cost would go up because there would be for the. Let me clarify. The total cost would go up from $5.7 million to approximately $7 million, but there would be an additional number of tests that would be administered. So I believe that the unit per unit cost would actually come down. I believe last time I talked about the inclusion of fixed versus variable costs. Essentially, what we'd be adding is a layer of variable cost to that per unit or to the total, and that would drive that per unit cost down a little bit in my mind.
Okay. Then, kind of following up, one of the things that's in Appendix D that I just want to sort of clarify a little bit. We have two items here. One is the English. There are lines, members on lines 2 and 3 of Appendix D, and it shows the English language proficiency contracts to develop tests. Yeah, try to say that fast. and you're showing a cost in there of for 2003-2005 of about $290,000, and then for 2005-2007 you have both a high and a low. So I'm going to guess that that's kind of a fixed number of $2 million. My question is this: is this something that is required by the No Child Left Behind statute, federal statute? And if there is any of this cost then offset by dollars that come to us from the feds specifically for this? If you could just talk about that a little bit.
Chair Crum will be happy to. The cost involved, the 0305 costs that are articulated there are specifically for development of the requirements for the English language proficiency assessments. The high and the low, the $2 million costs, are estimated costs to actually administer that test. Those funds are available through an allocation that we receive from the feds. And we're allowed to use those funds for that purpose.
Okay. And then one other question with regards to the Spanish reading contracts. Is it And again, you've got $200,000 for '03-'05, and then for '05-'07, pretty much straight across the line of $800,000. So between those two issues, you're looking at about $2.8 million. Is this something that is a cost to the state, or is it a cost to the district? And again, is that something that can be offset by federal funds, or is that something that is just the cost is going to be borne by the state?
Chair Crummell, again, those are costs that can be allocated or can be given to the federal funds. Federal funds allow those type of tests to be used, or those funds to be used for those type of tests. And again, similar to English language proficiency, the $200,000 in 03-'05 is for the development of the requirements, and the $800,000 is for the administration.
Okay. Sure. One second, Representative. Representative Flores, I think, had a question.
Quick question. Thank you. Mr. Crosby, then, these funds that were just pinpointed here, they can be offset by No Child Left Behind funds. Are any of those costs integrated or aggregated in or out of the state portion of the funding?
Representative Crummell, or Chair Crummell, Representative Flores, all of those costs currently, I believe, are allocated to the federal funds. The primary costs associated with the general fund are for, if memory serves me correctly, specifically for the performance assessments and the some of my staff.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up from the question that the Representative Flores has asked, my senior moments are becoming more and more frequent.
Get old, what's her name down there at the end of the dais?
It's okay, I forget sometimes too.
Doug, the Appendix D that you've given us indicates that the cost per unit of the exams administered, that's 420,000 tests. We have over 500,000, perhaps 550,000 students, so it would indicate that, you know, 20% of the kids are electing not to take the test, I guess. But the cost that this $13.69 of the estimated cost per unit of performance assessment based upon 420,000 tests, that's just the amount that's expended by the Department of Education, isn't it?
Chair Crummell, Representative Butler, to your second question, yes, that's just our cost to administer that test. Back to your first comment, the number of kids are represented. Remember, those are over two biennia, so that's 210,000 kids per biennia, and these kids were taking the test at the 5th, 8th, and 10th grade levels for two subject areas. So that's how those numbers come about, and you can guess a little over 40,000 kids per grade level per subject are testing.
And those that do not test?
Aren't. Chair Crummell, Representative Butler, they're not reflected in here. These are only the kids that actually take the tests.
And the number, Mr. Chair, is the number of percentage is what I'm looking for that do not test.
Chair Crummell, Representative Butler, I'm going to do some quick math in my head. There are 12 grade levels in, actually 13 in K through 12, and we only test three of them, so roughly, for the performance assessments, so that's roughly 25% of the kids are tested on any given year.
Excuse me, Doug, aren't there four levels? Isn't it 3, 5, 8, and 10?
Chair Crummell, no, in the performance assessment, it's only 5, 8, and 10.
Okay. Gotcha. Thank you.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm looking for if I walk into a 5th, 8th, or 10th grade class on the day that this would these tests were being administered, every seat would be full. I guess I'm looking for those that do not test or do not take the SIM test.
Chair Crummell, Representative Butler, there are reasons that parents can opt their children out of taking those tests, but for the most part, most kids take those tests, yes, in any given sitting.
And Doug, you were there, Mr. Chair.
I'll follow up.
You were there with us last Thursday and heard that even some school teachers are opting to have their youngsters test and refuse to take these tests. I'd like to know, I'd like to have a better feel of the representation from the Oregon Department of Education of those who feel that it's somewhat optional or not necessary to go ahead and test, that do not take the test. If we're talking about 98% taking the test, then I guess that's a different issue. But Mr. Chair, I think that when we come down to $13.69, and that doesn't include any overhead of administering the testing requirement statewide, my concern is that we heard testimony that as much as 2 weeks out of 40 are being used in the classrooms to prepare and monitor and proctor and those kinds of things relative to the teaching to the tests and preparing for them, that if we are taking, in fact, 5% of our classroom time away and at the relative cost that the state is committing to K-12 education in the classroom, that 5% represents something that may be very valuable and very needed. I'd sure hate to be expending 5% of my time in coursework that was going to yield nothing other than just an exam that I couldn't use and perhaps miss the definition of pi r squared or something like that. So I'm back in my district, when I say pi r squared, the people say, no, cornbread r squared, pi r round.
Thank you, Representative. Okay, and members, just to let you know, in a few minutes, I'm gonna ask the Oregon School Boards Association and the School Confederated Oregon School Administrators groups to come up and give us some ideas as far as costs that are borne by the districts individually. They have been gathering some information at my request. So they'll come up and share that information with us in a few minutes. But before I do call them up, I wanted to see if there were any other, if you had other questions for Mr. Costi relative to any of the information that was given out on Thursday.
I think Representative Flores had some questions.
Representative Flores?
I just did have a question, and back to the percentage of students who are taking these tests. I seem to recall that there was a figure brought forward in some testimony that there were only 35% of our students statewide, and I'm curious if you can give us some supporting information on that.
Chair Crummell, Representative Flores, I don't recall that specific comment, but what I could tell you is under the No Child Left Behind Act, the adequate yearly progress reports or the calculations that we do to determine whether a district is making adequate yearly progress or not requires a 95% participation in any given setting on any given grade level. So that would be a district number. We have the numbers of kids that actually are participating. How many are being excused from participating based on the criteria that we've laid out in the policy manual? I don't know the answer to that because that's a district by district decision.
Did you have other questions, Chris?
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
I have a question.
Representative Dingfeller.
Thanks. And I looked through the information over the weekend from the hearings. I couldn't be there last Thursday, but I just want clarification. I've visited all the schools in my district. I have over 25 schools for the two school districts, Park Rose and Portland Public. And I ask every principal and all the teachers, you know, what they think of no child left behind, of the SimCam, of all these different assessment tools that we have. And one of the, I do hear concerns about the 95% participation rate, because it's, there's not a lot of control over some of that. And what are the strings that are attached to that? Do we lose, I have a lot of Title I schools, do we lose federal funding basically if we're not meeting that, or is it that you'll get a fail, you'll be listed as a, as not meeting the standards in a failing school?
Chair Crummell, Representative Dingfelder, there are very serious ramifications to not meeting 95%. As you're probably aware, the No Child Left Behind Act, and specifically Adequate Yearly Progress, is a conjunctive model. So they give you 64 different ways to fail, and if you fail one, you fail all. And the Title I schools are most at risk of failing and receiving. They go into different levels, and I'm probably not going to get to the level of detail you're asking for, because that's not my area of expertise, but I do know that there are severe consequences for not meeting adequate yearly progress for Title I schools, to the extent that they can be taken over by an outside entity, and that their funding can be withheld.
Well, just a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative.
Well, for many of my schools, it's really a problem, and I think that it's almost counterproductive, because obviously part of the reason that we've, you know, that we're facing some of these challenges, we're not going to resolve in 1 year. I mean, that's many of my schools are facing the achievement gap, which is the one part of No Child Left Behind that I think is really valid. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I'm not a huge fan, but I think the achievement gap, especially in my schools that I see, is huge, and I do think it's a good tool for that, but my concern is that we don't allow, and I know this is not you, it's what you have to implement, enough time to respond to that. Do you have any suggestions about how we can, you know, I can work with my schools or try to bridge that gap?
Representative Crummell, Chair Dingfelder, actually there is a report that just came out from the National Conference on State Legislators.
I haven't seen it yet.
I'd be happy to provide that link to you. It's got some great information, some great feedback from your colleagues from other states about the act, and I'll go ahead and forward that to Mr. Keller so that he can share that web link with folks.
Thank you.
Okay. I think also Representative Dingfelder, when the folks from COSA and OSBA come up, they may be able to address your question a little bit more as well. So,
thank you.
Did you any other questions? I'm going to ask you a couple of things that I've heard, and I just want to. The SIM and the CAM are sort of an experiment, I guess, you know, to a large degree. We had a few legislators went to a meeting in, you know, 89 or 90 and thought this was just a terrific idea, and in the 91 session then managed to push through the Century 21 Schools Act and creating, you know, this whole thing. And what we heard on Thursday is that, you know, after what, 14 years, probably actually 12 or 13 of actually being implemented or starting to be implemented and kind of going through the process, that none of the colleges, either in-state or out-of-state, really give a rip about SIM and CAM. And what they want to know is, you know, attendance. They want to know that they received a diploma, that they got their credits, that they've got a decent GPA, and that they can do well on the SAT score, on the SAT test. But one of the things that I've heard, and I just want to either find out whether it's true or not, and that is that there's, with this great experiment that Oregon's been running, that there's been some grad students within our university system that may be sort of using this for their dissertations or for their master's papers, thesis, and that sort of thing, and if they're participating somehow in the design and that sort of thing. Is that, first of all, is that true? And And second of all, you know, I mean, this is sort of giving somebody an opportunity to build their career around something, but second of all, is that a valid reason for hanging on to something that, you know, in a lot of folks' mind might be an abysmal failure?
Chair Crummell, if you would allow, I'd like for Dr. Salam Noor to step forward. He might have some information.
Sure, that'd be fine.
That's more in his area of expertise.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Salam Noor from the Oregon Department of Education, responsible for curriculum and instruction. To answer your question, Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of specific dissertations that are being written on SIM and CAM specifically, if you will. However, the Oregon reform, the Oregon Education, Oregon Educational Act for the 21st century started the Oregon Education Reform Initiative in our state. And we've done a tremendous amount of work at the state level and nationally as well. We've been actually noted as a national state, as a leading state in school reform. Excuse me. Given the time frame that we've been on in pursuit of school reform in our state, I imagine that the work that we have done may lead to some research, whether in the form of papers, dissertations, etc. But I'm not aware of specific projects that focus on the certificate of initial mastery and the certificate of advanced mastery.
So we don't have anybody that you're aware of inside the department that's working on a master's or PhD that would be using this. And if there are projects going on out in the universities, you're unaware of that.
Mr. Chair, we do have staff members in the Department of Education that are pursuing advanced degrees, whether they are master's degrees or doctoral degrees. And they do much of the research, much of the work in the teacher preparation programs or teacher administration programs at the universities here in our state do focus on school reform in general, and therefore may relate to what we're doing in our schools or districts. But the fact that we have individuals pursuing advanced degrees for a variety of reasons, some of them could be personal interest on their part, some of them could be for career advancements, whether it's at the department or elsewhere, is not really dictating or driving what we do relative to education reform. We're trying to fulfill our responsibility based on the statutes that were enacted by the legislature, by you, and trying to implement the Oregon Educational Act, and specifically House Bill 2744 to the fullest. And House Bill 2744 specifically directs the department to work on SIM and CAM.
Dr. Noor, you mentioned that Oregon is nationally a leader in education reform. Can you help me understand something? And that is, if we're such a leader, and we've had these assessment tools of which, you know, we've gone out and sort of reinvented the wheel instead of using nationally statistically valid tools that were already available, sort of reinvented the wheel, not only on performance measures, but on skill and knowledge-based tests, which that's the side that really irritates the hell out of me, mostly. But if we are such a leader, can you help me understand why it is that even our own universities in this state, private, public, don't really give a rip about the certificate of initial mastery and the certificate of advanced mastery?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's really a valid question, and I want to be clear that I'm not trying to defend SIM and CAM. I think the committee is raising some really good questions relative to the value of the Certificate of Initial Mastery and the Certificate of Advanced Mastery, specifically to students. I think we haven't created incentives in our system to really motivate students to want to pursue a Certificate of Initial Mastery and a Certificate of Advanced Mastery. I would suggest that we are a leading state relative to the standards-based movement. We were one of the first states to adopt a standards-based education. And in my view, that's truly the highlight of the Oregon Educational Act for the 21st century and the education reform initiative we've been on, is that we clearly began to define what we expect of our students at grades 3, 5, 8, and 10. I would suggest that it's really the implementation of the Act is what perhaps became problematic. One of the issues that we're dealing with right now, especially with our school districts in the field, is the timing of the tests. For example, the SIM test is administered at the 10th grade. Some districts suggested that we perhaps ought to move it to the 11th grade to allow for additional time for students to gain and master the knowledge and skills that they're being tested on. So in terms of the value of it, it's something that, that we all need to take responsibility for. The university system, the business community, if you will, has not really requested that, has not required students to present their credentials, whether it's a SIM, a CAM, in some cases a high school diploma. Community colleges admit students into their programs without a high school diploma. So I think I appreciate the fact that the committee is looking at it from a very systematic point of view and trying to address some of the implementation issues that we encountered over time. But I would suggest that we do have a fairly sophisticated system. Our state was one of the first states to be approved by the U.S. Department of Education for its standards-based education and assessment system that we currently have in place.
Okay.
I hope that answers your question, Mr. Chair.
Sort of.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I'm a neophyte when it comes to education issues, and I'll readily admit that. I seek counsel from my education leaders in my community, my superintendents and school board members and education service district folks. But tell me more about the standards-based education. That's something that I'm sure you get books and books on, but maybe you could just share that with me.
Chair Kremel, Representative Butler, standards-based education in our state really established uniformity across the board in terms of what we really expect our students to know and be able to do. Currently, we have basically a Carnegie unit system that says a student must meet 22 credits to graduate from high school. The standards-based education begins to make meaning of those credits. So a student is not only graduating with two credits of math and science, we begin to define what those two credits really mean in terms of knowledge and skills. So in order for a student to transition from elementary to middle school, there is a body of knowledge and skills in the form of standards that says the student must be able to demonstrate that they have acquired the math skills and science skills and language arts skills and social studies skills to be prepared to advance to the next level. So it begins to cause alignment in terms of curriculum, so that what we teach in the middle schools is aligned to the elementary schools and the high schools, so we're not really repeating and duplicating what students are learning. It begins to focus on the student and what we expect students to know and be able to do to prepare them for further education, should they transition to a community college, university, or a private career school for that matter, or to be prepared to enter the workforce. One of the skills that we have actually, if I may just share with you, it's really a body of knowledge and skills. That's really the best way to describe the standards. And it's defining not the curriculum, but really the level of knowledge that's expected of students in these curricular areas, in the eight subject matter areas.
So that because I have a standards-based education with uniformity and meaning of credits within the state of Oregon, that would mean that I'd be able to take my 11th year of school in Ontario, and then I'd be able to come for my 12th year of school at Wilson, Woodrow Wilson High School in Portland, and the classes would be substantially identical in my progression, and that I would it would create a seamless education from K through 12, no matter where I was at in the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the classes may not necessarily be identical, but the standards that the student is expected to achieve in social studies, for example, will be the same. So the student will be able to understand concepts and communicate concepts and represent those verbally and in writing in the area of social studies, regardless of what school they're at.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may, so the book might be different. If my junior social studies book was A, the book for my senior social studies and a different school might be B, but it would follow progression. I wouldn't be going backwards in my math skills. I wouldn't be going backwards in my other science skills, chemistry or those kinds of sciences. And with regard to the social sciences, those would be in progression from the 10th grade in Southern Oregon to the 11th grade in Eastern Oregon to the 12th grade in the Portland area.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, you're absolutely right. The curriculum is locally determined. The school district or the school board determines the curriculum, the books that they want to use to offer the instruction. But the standard in terms of what we expect that student to know in middle school and high school and be able to do will be the same regardless of what school the student is at. And you're absolutely right, sir. It's really to promote a seamless education system within K-12, but also to allow for transition, smooth transition to further education and training as kids exit high school.
So follow up,
Representative.
So logically it then follows that I should be able then to come in and do a SIM and this process, 8th grade and 10th grade, and that would be absolutely relevant and absolutely demonstrative, because these are statistically valid tools that identify that the standards-based education I'm receiving in Oregon is uniform throughout the state, and that a high school graduation certificate with my certificate of initial mastery is just as powerful, just as relevant, just as meaningful at a high school in Southern Oregon as it is in Northeast, Northwest, or Southeastern Oregon.
Chair Kremel, Representative Butler. In theory, that may be the case, because the SIM is not a requirement at all schools. It really is an optional certificate. Both the SIM and the CAM are optional at all districts throughout the state. I'm not aware of a single district that actually requires it for graduation. However, we have studies. We have what's called the first-year study and the second-year study that was conducted by the Oregon University System that shows a direct correlation between students achieving the Certificate of Initial Mastery and their rate of success, the rate of retention and completion at the university level. So there is some degree of predictability for those students that achieve the Certificate of Initial Mastery and their ability to be successful at the university level. We do have a scientifically based study that actually draws that correlation. Students, however, choose to pursue a Certificate of Initial Mastery based on their own personal interest, if you will. The schools provide the opportunity for them to pursue a SIM and a CAM, and students have the option whether to pursue that or not. The assessment associated with that is really a measure at a point in time to see how the student is progressing relative to the standards. The assessments are based on the standards that the state established for students in grades 3, 5, 8, and 10. So the assessment is really, and it's important to keep that in perspective, because it doesn't measure everything that the student knows, but basically says, at this point, we're going to measure the student's attainment of those standards at this level, whether it's 3, 5, 8, and 10. Based on that information, districts should look at their students that have taken that assessment and identify where there may be some gaps, identify where their strengths are, and perhaps build on those. That should provide them some really critical information to identify students that are doing well and those that are struggling, to look at their curriculum, to look at their instructional programs, to look at the opportunities and offerings they're providing to their students to help them achieve the standards. But a number of assessments do go on a regular basis in the classroom that are of great value to teachers as well.
Mr. Chair, I don't question that this assessment tool is valid and valuable in the classroom to our teaching staff, and to be able to compare teaching methods and those kinds of issues. I really don't even know that much about it, other than that what we've heard and had testimony in. And I guess that's a pretty good indication for the education community within the K-12 system to identify where they're at. But the concern I have is that to a person, we didn't hear anyone who said This is a valuable education, or this is a valuable education assessment tool for us to determine whether or not you're ready for either the workplace,
right,
or whether you're ready for community college or the Oregon University system. So either we've got a terrible sales job of a really good tool, or we've got a marginal tool that's really valuable to some teachers in the system and some educators within the system, but it doesn't leak outside the classroom to K-12 or beyond K-12. So I'm very concerned that within either the higher education communities or within the business community, that sales job basically failed in its efforts to let people know that this person, and we actually had one person say, and by the way, I wrote down my job application or my application for university that I had completed the SIM and had finished my portfolio, and it was waived. They would like to have discussed some of their accomplishments that they felt were honest to goodness accomplishments, but they were asked instead, and these are some of the questions within the SIM, I understand, can you write, can you calculate, will you show up for your classes or your work schedule on time, and more life skills, that I'm sure there must be some life skill attachment there. But again, it's a really good tool that we've had a hard time selling outside the schoolroom, or it's a really lousy tool that we're not that is just used internally. So I'm still on the borderline there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, if I may just comment on that. I think you raised some really valid points, and I think it's important to draw a distinction between the SIM and the CAM as certifications and what those really mean. The one thing that I truly value about our education is the standards-based system that we currently have in place. Our universities and community colleges actually use the standards that we've identified for our students in K-12 as part of their educational programs and degrees and courses, if you will. The university system uses on a regular basis the newspaper that we publish annually on the Oregon standards. So I believe there is a great deal of alignment and collaboration going on relative to the standards. The certification that certifies whether a student has met those standards or not continues to be a challenge, if you will, and I think partly it's due to the fact, as you mentioned, Representative Crummell, that our universities and business sector has not created incentives for students to really pursue those. And right now, the desire on a student's part to really attain a certificate of initial mastery or advanced mastery is personally motivated. You have motivated students that are high achievers, and that will pursue any and all credentials that are available to them in K-12. And those motivated students will do that on their own, whether the district actually encourages them and nudges them to do that or not. But we have not really created enough value, in my view, as you stated, Representative Butler, for the certification, for students to really want that, for their parents to want that. But the distinction that I'd like to point out is that the standards that we have in our system are very much highly valued by teachers and by the post-secondary partners that we work with.
That being said, then you have to help me understand why, and I saw an application for Western Oregon University, it's a brand new application, no place on there. Is there anything about, is there even a question, have you earned a certificate of initial or advanced mastery? If our university system is in line with what's going on in K-12, help me understand why our State Board of Higher Education hasn't even required our state universities to put it on their application somewhere. I don't care if it's at the very bottom, but put it on there somewhere. And maybe what you're saying is absolutely correct. There's no value to it. Consequently, nobody cares about it, and they're not going to bother to ask about it.
Chair Crummell, it's optional. It is not required. The legislation did not require it for graduation. and for the Board of Education or the Board of Higher Education to actually require it would, in the case of the K-12 Board of Education specifically, it would be really overstepping the authority that the Board has and the Department of Education has to mandate it for graduation. It's a feature of the system that we currently have. What universities do value, however, and forgive me for repeating this, is the standards, are the standards that we have in the system. Because when a student actually is admitted to a community college or a university, most often than not, they take a placement test. And that placement test measures their knowledge and skills. And we're working with our university partners to align our K-12 standards with the entrance requirements for universities and community colleges. So if a student actually demonstrates in high school that they've achieved, let's say, the Certificate of Initial Mastery, that automatically equates to a placement test, and the student would not have to take that placement test again. So we're pursuing some alignments based on the standards, and that's really the beauty of the standards-based education system that we have, is it allows us some uniformity across the board that allows us to establish statewide degrees and statewide parameters that inform how community colleges, universities work with high schools. But the universities don't require it for admission. You're absolutely right.
Kind of going to that performance standard for just a second, and members, we've kind of digressed a little bit off of the cost structures that I think we will come back to, but with regards to the performance sort of things over the course of, I saw a chart yesterday, and I can get a copy of it if I need to, but over the course of the last 10 years, I think it covered the time from 94 to 2004. It showed that that Oregon, with regards to the SAT scores, had actually lagged behind the rest of the country in terms of the growth. In terms of, you know, so for example, I believe it was the reading and verbal scores that showed like a 504 in 1994. And then it went up to 516 or something in 2004 nationally, but the state was about half of that. Now, granted, the state was slightly above the national average, but that growth was not the same. I would have anticipated that with this kind of a program, that growth would exceed the rest of the state, and I would also suppose or expect that our placement in terms of the national, you know, in terms of where we are in state ranking, as opposed to being, you know, 25th or 26th, that we would be, you know, in the top 15 or in the top 10. Can you address that for me,
Representative Chair Crummell? Not specifically without having the information in front of me, but those scores tend to fluctuate due to a variety of reasons. They fluctuate based on state and national participation in those exams. I think we stayed fairly competitive or comparable to other states. But one thing that that Oregon has is really a split. Oregon is both an SAT and ACT state. So not all students in our state actually take the SAT exam. So I think right now we have better information on who's actually participating in those exams, and we can actually disaggregate that data. And we're seeing actually increased participation in our minority student population, increased performance on their part. Closing the achievement gap is a big part of that. Some other states actually receive what's referred to as an advanced placement incentive program that helps students actually take advanced placement exams at the secondary level that really prepare them for SAT-type exams. And we're seeing an increase in participation as a result of the Advanced Placement Incentive Program, the APEP program in our state. We've only had it for a couple of years. Other states like Washington, for example, has had that for about 5 or 6 years. So you see a spike in participation on their part. I believe having these resources will help us make those opportunities more accessible to students, and will encourage more students to believe that they are prepared to take the SAT exam. Again, I think a lot of the scores are driven by participation and national trends in general.
But the, I mean, you have a certain number of students that are going to be highly motivated, and you have a certain number of students that are going to go ahead and take the either the SAT or the ACT test,
right.
one of the two, because they're looking for placement into a university type of system. But wouldn't you, and we know that over the course of the last 10 or 15 years anyway, that about 50% or so of our students, and that's been pretty standard over the years, but about 50% of our students take the SAT test and then go on to university level work. But wouldn't you expect that with the standards that we've put in place, that our SAT scores would be pushing higher, and that Oregon would be looking at being in the top 10 or top 15 states in the country in terms of not necessarily the numbers of students or the percentages changing, but that the scores would be of those that are taking it would be starting to push upward.
Chair Krummel, and I'm going to invite my colleague Mr. Costa here to weigh in on this as well, because he deals with the assessment scores. I think it's a fair expectation that by having a rigorous demanding standards-based education, that our students would do well on national standardized exams. Why we're not progressing to the degree that you mentioned, I can't really speak to that. However, I think we stay fairly competitive, and our education system is considered to be one of the high demanding, if you will, and rigorous education system in the country based on the standards that we have in place. And it's a system that's designed by Oregon teachers and with Oregon standards that are different from national standards, and that may actually contribute to that to a degree, but I don't think it's the main reason. I think it's fair to expect our students to do better. As a citizen of this state, I would like to see our students do better. But specifically why that's not seen, I can't really tell you for sure.
Chair Krummel.
Can I just ask a question right here? Wasn't the advanced mastery to bring us to a level of actually being able to move into the workplace? Wasn't that what it was originally? That was my understanding, was the initial mastery was to help you go on from there, but I thought the advanced was to really bring it to some job skills. I think that's what I heard Dr. Emmer say.
I mean, let's let Mr. Kosky address that and then pass the ball back to Dr. Knorr to answer your question, if that's all right, Representative.
Just as a follow-up, Chair Krummel, to Dr. Knorr's comment about and your question about growth on the SATs over time, I have not looked at that. I'd be happy to have some of my staff sit down with a report that your staff are looking at and do some analysis side by side. I think that would be fine.
I think that would be a valid for not only us but for the education committee to get that information. Dr. Knorr, you were going to respond to.
If I may, please, Chair Krummel, Representative Butler, the Certificate of Advanced Mastery was modified over the past 2 to 3 years, in particular by the State Board of Education. Currently, it requires students to participate in what we call in Oregon the career-related learning standards, to achieve the career-related learning standards, which are really the SCANS skills, if some of you are familiar with the national terminology for that. It's basically the soft skills that we expect students to have in terms of communication, teamwork, employment foundations, basic workplace and employability skills, if you will. And we prefer to see those actually embedded in curriculum across the board and not necessarily have students receive them in a particular class, so students see the relevance between teamwork, communication, workplace readiness in math as much as they do see it in industrial and engineering or natural resources or agriculture, etc. The Certificate of Advanced Mastery also calls on students to participate in career-related learning experiences that actually put students in a real-life environment, either in the school or outside the school, in the form of an internship, a job shadow, an apprenticeship, an externship. It's their hands-on experiences that help them identify what they wish to do once they leave high school and the type of education they need to pursue to support their career goals and interests. It also calls on the students to demonstrate extended application, and I think that's where the advanced notion comes into place, where a student has actually mastered the knowledge and skills required for English, science, language arts, social studies, engineering perhaps, natural resources. The extended application calls on that student to apply their knowledge and skills in a more advanced, more extended application-based kind of fashion. So a student may actually have completed their SIM for and have the skills in language, arts, science, and math. Now they have to apply that to a real-life problem. It doesn't have to be outside the walls of the school. It could be projects and activities that students do in the school. They have to relate it to a career area, for example. They have to relate it to something that they're interested in. So it's very much personalized.
I think where I was trying to figure out was that in that process, what were the ACT and SAT, weren't they to also evaluate some of those same things? And do we have two methods of evaluation between the SAT and ACT and the SIM and CAM that move, that correlate absolutely parallel to one another? Or do they fluctuate all over the board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the SAT measures specifically academic knowledge and skills. The ACT, however, has a workplace readiness and employability component that's referred to as work keys. It allows us to measure both the academic knowledge and skills that we would measure on a statewide assessment like the STEM, and it also would allow us to measure the employability skills that we would measure on a local assessment.
That's the ACT.
And that's the ACT. And we've had conversations actually with the ACT folks relative to our statewide assessment, and we expressed an interest in looking at what they have to offer, and we were also comparing the cost estimates that they were provided by them to the cost estimates that we have in our system currently. But the ACT does provide a comprehensive assessment system. However, it's only grades 8 through 11. So it doesn't account for the assessments at the earlier grades in 5 and 3 in particular. The other issue that we were trying to sort of sort out is that the ACT, Oregon is more of an SAT state rather than an ACT state. But we see a growing number of students actually taking the ACT. We see community colleges requiring the ACT.
Isn't that really driven, though, by where they're going to apply for school? I mean, if they apply to the University of Alabama, for example, and Alabama requires the ACT, then that's what the student's going to sit for. If they, now granted, many schools across the country will accept both, the SAT and the ACT, but some universities will only accept the ACT. So you've got, and then you've also got students that will sit for both exams,
right?
Correct? So to say that Oregon is an SAT state versus an ACT state, isn't that really pointing out that the universities in our state primarily require the SAT as opposed to the ACT test?
Chair Kremel, I appreciate your comments, and please allow me to clarify. I'm not suggesting that Oregon only takes an SAT or requires an SAT exam only. What I'm suggesting is that what we see the trend in our state is that our universities in particular tend to favor the SAT over the ACT. But I think much of that is driven by the marketplace and what universities actually require. And if you look at universities or higher ed institutions across the country, some actually allow for both. They will allow the student to admit ACT scores or SAT scores. Some are very specific that they will only look at SAT scores. So I appreciate the opportunity to clarify. I'm not suggesting that we are an only SAT state, but we see a trend in our state. I mean, when we look at the students and the tests that they actually sit in for, it's really more SAT than SAT than ACT. But we're seeing an increase in students participating in the ACT exam.
One of the things I want to ask you is just kind of this is more of a theoretical, educational theoretical type of question. Wouldn't you agree that the SIM and the CAM are really based on a mass remodel of education as opposed to the traditional model of education? Traditional model of education, of course, says, you know, you start in kindergarten or grade 1 and you go through grade 12 and you get this piece of paper, it's called a high school diploma, and then based on scores that you got in school and everything, then, you know, somebody might think that you're okay to go on to a university, and there's maybe some predictability, and you take an SAT test or ACT test and that sort of thing. Whereas a mastery model of education is really not based on, it's not based on time at all. It's based on knowledge. And it's based on being able to master the knowledge and master the skills and move on to the, and then move on to the next level. And in our, and so in the mastery model, you might have a third grader that's working at the seventh grade level, and it doesn't matter, but they're working at that level because they have mastered those skills as they've gone along. And then at the age of 13, they have actually mastered what's going on with an 18-year-old that's a senior in high school, and they're quite frankly ready to move into a university setting or a community college setting. But our implementation based on, so that's what the, that's what really what the SIM and the CAM are based on, is a mastery model. Would you, let me just ask you yes or no, would you agree with that?
Chair Kremel, yes, if I have the opportunity to elaborate on that.
I just wanted a yes or a no. So, but our implementation of this has been flawed, and whether it's because of the direction that the department's getting from the legislature, or it's because of the way the department has seen fit to try to implement it, our implementation has been flawed, and it's been flawed for two reasons. Number one is that we're saying you can't take the SIM until 10th grade. If you have a 13-year-old that's ready to take the SIM, then why in the hell don't we let them take it? Why do we say, no, you have to wait until you're a 16-year-old and in the 10th grade? That's the first flaw. The second flaw is in our funding scheme, because we fund based on seat time. We do not fund based on knowledge base. We do not fund based on performance. We fund based on seat time, based on a student sitting in the seat. And if we try to move that student, that 13-year-old, into a university setting, then we have these guys coming to us, and I'm pointing to the COSA and OSBA people, we have those guys coming to us and saying, you can't do that because you're taking funding away from the local school districts when you do that. But if the student's not there, why should we be paying for it in the first place? But we have created this flaw. We're trying to take what is educationally, you know, depending on who you talk to, a theory that might work, and we've tried to implement it in a traditional setting, and it will not work if we continue to do it. Would you agree with that?
Chair Kremel, I think what you've articulated essentially is the challenge that we have today. I think we designed a world-class education system with the Oregon Education Act for the 21st century. I think the legislation at the time was very visionary, and it responded to a need, not just a state need, but a national need. If you recall, at the time, there was a national report called A Nation at Risk, mm-hmm. and it was supported very much by the business leaders across the country. And basically, it said, our students are graduating from high school with a third grade, fifth grade, even seventh grade.
Well, that's called social promotion,
right.
Which never should have started. And don't get me started on that.
No, but I agree with that. Basically, so we tried to respond by designing an education system that really measures what students know and able to do, that measures the skills and the knowledge that we expect of students in elementary, middle, and high school, that prepare them to go to college or the workplace. In the meantime, we continue to maintain the traditional Carnegie unit system. So essentially, we've tried to implement a standards-based education while maintaining and preserving the education system that we have in place. What I would suggest is that we've made tremendous progress, and our schools and districts are doing some remarkable things and offering students some incredible opportunities in terms of the learning and the experiences that they receive on a daily basis. So although that we have maintained this duality of a standards-based education that basically does allow, in some cases, a 13-year-old to sit for the 10th grade assessment. I can tell you from my personal experience, this was a couple of years ago when my son was in middle school. He was really excited to be sitting in, he was in sixth grade, and was really excited to be sitting in an eighth grade math class, until the teachers told him to look at that kid that's sitting in the corner that happened to be from the elementary school that was coming up to the middle school to take math with them. So I think schools are offering students opportunities to advance and develop along an educational continuum that meets their needs. However, we still have a standards-based education system and a Carnegie-based education system. The State Board of Education a couple of years ago provided districts the opportunity to develop policies to award credit based on proficiency, which means if you have a ninth grade student or an eighth grade student that has mastered the skills that we require of our juniors and seniors, then the district has the authority to award that student credit based on the proficiencies and the mastery of those skills. So we have some really remarkable innovations in our system. And I would invite you to go out and visit some schools like David Douglas and Reynolds and Nyssa High School in Eastern Oregon, and schools throughout the state that are absolutely fabulous and really have a 21st century, very innovative, very progressive education system. But we do have the challenge that you articulated, Mr. Chair, about having a standards-based education and a Carnegie unit traditional education system running parallel to one another, and that does create some confusion at times.
I would agree it does, and I can tell you that I've been in the schools. I'm a substitute teacher, and I can also tell you what the attitude of a lot of the teachers, at least in the metro area, is, because it's really fun to sit in the be in the lunchroom, and you've heard of being that proverbial fly on the wall.
Yes.
Well, I'm able to do that because they don't know what I do in my other life. What's really funny is a lot of times my picture's right there on the wall because of the OEA poster. And I've had one teacher that has recognized me or my name.
Mr. Chair, okay. Other legislative members whose pictures show up in the post office.
Yes, I am avoiding showing up in the post office. That's for sure, Representative. I do want to appreciate the input. I want to bring us back to the cost factors here for a minute, because I want to get Jim Green and Chuck Bennett up here. But before I let you leave, Mr. Cosby, I need to ask you the same question that I asked you the other day, and that's relative to the math performance tests. They were flawed. They basically got thrown out. It's $1.2 million down the tube. I don't like flushing dollars down the toilet. And I asked you who was accountable and if anyone was held accountable for that at the Department of Education. And you didn't know the answer then. I sort of put you on warning that you would face the same question again today, and so maybe you can enlighten us.
Chair Crummell, first of all, personnel issues I'm not at liberty to discuss in a public hearing.
Sure.
But what I would like to say is what we learned out of that and some of the practices that we've implemented subsequent to that. But even before that, what I'd like to take the opportunity to do is say that when Susan Castillo came into office, Superintendent Castillo came into office, she looked at the skills and abilities of staff around the agency and spent the first 6 months reorganizing and redesigning the way the office is managed. They looked at my level of expertise and said, I'm a systems guy. My background is in accounting and implementation of large systems, enterprise resource planning systems, ERP we refer to them as. And her staff said that that's an appropriate level of expertise to put into this department. So I came into the assessment division about 9 months ago. So one of the first issues I faced when I came into the office was the math problem solving issue at that point in time. That's when we did not use the 10th grade scores. So it was actually one third of the 120,000 that we actually had, or the 1.2 million that we had to scrap. What I think the committee understands by a virtue of the work that's being done in assessments is that it's fairly complex type of work. It is stuff that, in from an accounting background, we are in a very immature industry. And because of the fact that we are in an immature industry, we have to focus on processes. And while some of those processes have been very well articulated as I went through the item development set of processes, others haven't been articulated so well. So my charge to my staff is I want to do a process review and evaluation to glean from that where the areas of risk are and where the areas that we can create efficiencies are. Partially, I think, in looking at it in retrospect, in the early days, a lot of focus was placed on technical adequacy studies and bringing national experts together and advisors from the local community. That type of activity was dialed back on, if you will, during the 0103 budget cutting scenario. It's something that I feel very important that we bring back to the table and have those committees and that type of input. I don't believe the agency, even if we were to outsource the entire assessment system, could afford to do that without those type of activities. We need that stakeholder input. We need the technical advisors from a national level. We need our advisors from the assessment community throughout the districts. One of the first things I did when I came into the office was ask for an internal audit. During Susan Castillo's reorg, she appointed an internal auditor to the agency. And I said, well, if I'm going to take over, I need somebody to look over my shoulder and watch what's happening. So I requested an internal audit. We're in the final phases of that audit. We received the management letter the other day, and that information will be posted. We are going through a national compliance review. The federal government is requiring all state agencies to do a technical review of their assessment systems to see that they align with or conform to No Child Left Behind requirements. So
let me ask you this, in relation to that, if we were to eliminate the SIM and CAM altogether, go to a direct the department to go to a nationally normed skills and knowledge based assessment, would we be in compliance with No Child Left Behind?
Chair Crummell, you would have to look at all of the details, but essentially, yes, you would still be in compliance. Many, many other states are doing national
And would we lower our costs?
Chair Crummell, I couldn't answer that question until we do a detailed request for proposal based on very specific business requirements.
Okay, thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Costa, you just stated that all the states are going through yet another level of compliance review as to whether or not they're meeting the requirements of No Child Left Behind. Is that something in addition? Did I misunderstand you? Is that in addition to the review that is required to have the state selected?
Chair Crummell, Representative Flores, yeah, it is an addition. This is specifically looking at the assessment system. So all components of the assessment system are looked at, and technical compliance studies or adequacy studies have to be initiated at some level for each of the different areas. So they look at compliance with the content standards, the alignment to the content standards, how we deliver, administer those tests, how the items are developed, are we following sound standards processes, educational standards processes.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I would like to get Jim Green and good old what's his name, Chuck Bennett, up here. And the questions that I have for the two of you basically are: can you give us an idea of the district's? We're going to shift back into costing factors here. Can you give us an idea of the hard costs that the districts face with the SIM and the CAM, and then also? Can you give us an idea of, and if the districts have responded, I know you've been collecting some information at my request, can you give us an idea of the cost-benefit analysis that maybe, you know, that we can see whether there's a real benefit to the cost that we're seeing to the districts relative to SIM and CAM?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I think given the quality of information, I'll alert you that I think trying to do a cost-benefit from the information that's available is going to be very difficult. I think you're having the right discussion as to whether or not the policy is the correct policy. Is this the right way to be going with assessment? But trying to extrapolate value from this data, I think, is going to be very difficult. We took a look at the expenditures on assessment and testing from the last audited database initiative information, which is 2002-2003. The assessment and testing function is 2230, and the total reported spent statewide on assessment is $2.7 million.
This now, Chuck, that's borne by the school districts is $2.7 million.
But I want to really have you put an asterisk on this $2.7 million. Looking at the data, 83 districts reported zero spending on assessment and testing under this function. Portland was one of the districts that reported zero spending on this function. So this number, I think, just in all honesty, is meaningless at this point. What appears to be happening, I think Jim will explain this further from the information he's developed from the districts, is that the districts appear to have, some of them are keeping pretty good books on assessment and testing, pretty good clear understanding of the cost to them. Others very clearly don't see a materiality in these cost numbers and are incorporating them into their instructional numbers. They've got teachers doing assessment, but the vast majority of time is they're teaching. They're not going to the trouble to count the amount of time being spent on assessment. I think that's a real difficulty here.
Okay, but let me ask you just kind of to point to that for a second. So when I get called in as a substitute, and I know that the reason that I was called in is because Teacher Smith has been is coming to Salem to work with the Department of Education, or has gone to the district office to do something that is relevant to assessment. You mean to tell me that the school districts aren't keeping track of that?
I think they're keeping track of it under another function in many cases. If they're keeping track of substitute teachers relative to other than under some sort of substitute teacher category, but I think that's the problem, Mr. Chairman. In the attempt to fix district costs on this, is there has not been either the requirement or the discipline to treat these costs separately. And I think that creates a real difficulty in terms of assigning a cost. So I guess what I'm suggesting to you is that while the cost numbers are interesting, and whether or not this saves, it will save money. I mean, you know, if you got rid of assessment, you'd save money. There's no question about it. You can't do it, but it would save money. I think the better question is the one that you've engaged in, is whether or not the department should put out an RFP and find out about competition in the marketplace. We happen to think that's not a bad idea, that The department, this question has gone on for a long time about whether or not this assessment program is cost-effective, just in the broadest sense. And I think that a well-done RFP, a fairly done RFP that allows the marketplace to compete is just a real good idea. I was pleased to hear it mentioned by the department. I think that's a good idea. The other question I think that you're asking, and I think it runs to the fundamentals of our current system, is whether or not the Education Act of the 21st century, 5 years into the 21st century, is out of date. And I'd submit to you it is. Times are moving rapidly, I think that it's fair to say that at this point, 5 years into it, into this century, changing federal law with No Child Left Behind and its requirements on the state, which Oregon perhaps predicted through the Education Act of the 21st century, the kind of standards and expectations of students that is incorporated in the federal act. But the federal act supersedes, and the federal act is driving this now, and whether or not our system as it's currently constituted is the best fit with NCLB is a perfectly reasonable question to ask. There is no question that there is a lot of debate about SIM and CAM, and whether or not SIM and CAM fits in this anymore is a question that absolutely needs to be taken up. This was done, put together before NCLB, before any kind of cyber learning. We didn't have the explosion we've seen in alternative education opportunities, particularly homeschooling, charter schools, etc. This is a different education environment than the legislature addressed when it put together the law that created SIM and CAM. There's no question we're going to have standards, that we're going to have grade-level benchmarks. These are things that we're going to have to do in relation to No Child Left Behind. There's going to have to be very clear accountability and determination of why, an accurate determination of why students do or don't meet these standards or benchmarks and what can be done. And then I think the question, and I think this is where you come into a SIM-CAM question, should you have a relevant reward of some kind as students, aside from a diploma, or is it the diploma, or is it a certificate of what, or is it, should we ever try the certificate of anything experiment again, given what our success at this point with SIM and CAM, but is there a relevant reward for students? And by relevant, I mean, is there one that is accepted by employers, potential employers, higher education, the community as statements of success and achievement and a level of knowledge that is important to a business or college or whatever. In terms of the university system, I guess, accepting SIM and CAM at this point, the university system doesn't often accept credits out of community colleges, let alone recognize our certificates out of high school. So I think at this point there may be some problem at the university system level as they look back on the rest of us, but certainly this is a really good time, we think, to have this discussion. We hope this discussion doesn't end here, doesn't end in the education committee, that it moves through and that you take a complete look at this entire area. So thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
Chuck, thank you. Do you think that part of that, the OUS system sort of looking back on the rest of the system, is that just an arrogance problem with, that universities sort of inherently have, that they look at, I went from a community college to a university, and I had all but five credits transferred. Mm-hmm. And that was from a community college in Washington to a university in Utah. Everything but five credits transferred. and, you know, rightfully so. The five credits that didn't transfer were sub-100 level class that I took because I wanted to take it. So, I mean, but we have credits from the community colleges, 100 and above, that the universities look at and won't plug in somewhere within their breadth system or whatever and transfer those credits in. Correct?
I you're beyond my pay grade here in terms
okay.
of...
Okay, that's okay.
I'm going to speak anecdotally on this, and I think it's one that OUS can answer and the community colleges can answer better, but it's certainly an area that, as we look at the expanded options program, which, by the way, I just want to mention, we've been trying to work with AOI and actually we're pretty supportive of this expanded options program at this point and trying to find a way short of you all taking a complete look at this education system. We're going to continue to piecemeal this thing, and we think expanded options is a piece we've got to add. We can't have 11th and 12th grade students not having full use of their time through the educational system and the opportunity to experience college and work. We just can't do it. This is about kids, and we're not going to abandon them on this issue. So
I agree.
We're working hard on this issue this session.
Thank you. Representative Flores, did you have a question?
I did have a question. Thank you very much. I think it's important to note that, and when you're talking about this education act having been put in place before No Child Left Behind. Actually, No Child Left Behind was a reauthorization which put some accountability into a prior authorization in 1992, which maybe was somewhat of the platform for which the Oregon model was launched. But the Bill Clinton reauthorization did put into place the framework for what we're looking at now as No Child Left Behind, only with accountability built in. So I think that's important that we all wrap around that a little bit, and it's not often clarified for us. But I wanted to go back. Okay, we cannot get a handle on the, if you would call them soft costs, I guess, of the schools there, because somehow they're not tracking it or putting it, their cost directly under the column of what is it, what are we paying to have these assessments?
Right.
What can you give us an idea of, just as a matter of record keeping then, what are the costs per day when a school or a district does not have class because it's teacher in service, and whether that in service is preparing for the SIM or the assessment or what have you. Can you give us that type of figure?
Well, Madam or Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
No, we really
have. I'm having a hard time. No, Representative Flores. I'm thinking about the answer. It varies from district to district on
sure.
the cost per day, and so I can't give you a cost. There may be a way to arrive at that, and I just can't think of it off the top of my head. What we do lose is a contact day with students, and I think that's real important every time we do this. And that kind of contact day loss is an important loss. So.
And therefore, there's value attached.
Absolute
to it.
Value.
And
absolutely.
Sorry, follow up. I guess what I'm trying to get from you is, and I understand that the cost per district or per school
yeah.
vary,
yeah.
but is there a way that we could graph or chart that and take a look?
Yeah, I'm sure we could get an average cost per day, but I would just. The dollar amount's important. The lost education day perhaps may be more important and of more value. As we spend time on this kind of assessment activity. I think we agree. I wish I knew the number for you, though. I don't.
And it's difficult, to assign a value to the loss to the child.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Jim?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. Before we lose that point, Representative Flores, if I could just address her question, Mr. Chair.
Please do.
I think we can try to find a number for that, because we knew what it cost Hillsborough to lose 17 days. you know, when they cut 17 days off their school year last year, we knew what that cost was because they had that budget hole. So we can try to extrapolate that data out for you if you want us to do that, and we can get that back to Mr. Keller, Community Administrator, if you want us to.
I think that'd be valuable to have.
We'll work on that with COSA as well. Mr. Chair, my purpose here today is to talk to you about some of the costs that aren't in what we call Function Code 2230 of the Database Initiative. That's the function code where I think Mr. Bennett laid out the cost of the district that they show up in the Database Initiative, DBI, for assessment and testing. And what we did, the Oregon School Boards Association also has housed in it the Oregon Association of School Business Officials, the money managers in the school districts. Their executive director is on our staff. And she sent out an email for us at your request to the school business officials asking for essentially what costs are associated with statewide assessment and the development of the Certificate of Initial Mastery, Certificate of Advanced Mastery, and the costs associated with that that do not reflect in their function code 2230. And we're continuing to get that data in, but I can relay just some anecdotal data. And a couple of the comments that came back were much like this one from the Cascade School District, which is here in Marion County, that said a lot of the costs were incurred 10 to 12 years ago when this system was implemented. So now they are embedded in the everyday ongoing cost of curriculum development, assessment, things that just go on in districts. But they also indicated, you know, like in Cascade School District, they said that they currently pay a fee to an online provider for managing their assessment scores based on the web-based assessment, TESA, that the department runs at about $3,600 annually. Other districts sent, you know, more data than that. Eugene looked at, in 04-05, the Eugene School District budgeted almost $50,000 for what they call targeted staff development, focusing on improving student performance to reach state standards. And they also budgeted a little under $104,000 for assistance with scoring, recording, reporting on student work samples and progress, and assistance with assessment process. And the data goes on. I wish Representative Butler was here, because one of the districts that did respond was a little district out in his area called Adrian, very small school district out in Malheur County. And they said, in addition to the function code 2230 data that Mr. Bennett relayed, they spent about $7,000 additionally. And their key comment in their email was, that doesn't sound like a lot, but we're a very small school district, and $7,000 to cost associated with that is dramatic. And I can share this data, and I'll share that data with the committee administrator as we get that information in. But I think the main key is that when you ask for data on this, some of it is embedded in what school districts do on a day-to-day basis, because we've dealt with this act now for 10 to 12 years. So it's going to be hard to extrapolate some of that data. When we asked the question the way that you had us ask it to our districts, though, we got back information. We're continuing to get that back. And as I said, I'll share that with you. Centennial did a pretty good estimate. They're up in Multnomah County of what the costs were. Redmond did. What it costs to have substitute comes in, what it costs to have the secretary do the assessment scoring and relaying that data to the Department of Ed. So it may not be in the function code 2230. It's how you ask that question of the districts. And we'll get that data, as I've said, and we'll continue to get that data and relay that to the committee.
I would greatly appreciate that. And by giving that to committee staff, that'll be terrific, because committee staff for this committee is also committee staff for the House Education Committee. So he can get that information going both ways, and I would greatly appreciate that. I think, you know, one of the things that you pointed out is of course how we ask the question and trying to get the answer. And it sounds like Redmond really understood what we were going after, because we want all of the costs associated with it, and the cost of a substitute coming in is extremely important. I can't believe. And maybe this is part of the problem of having bureaucrats manage the business side instead of having business people manage the business side. But I can't believe that they don't know why they've got a substitute, for example, coming into a building. I mean, I as a substitute always knew why I was going, always know why I'm going into a building. And I can't believe that the district office doesn't have, you know, because if they've got to pay, if the teacher's sick, they've got to pay for that under one part of the contract. Excuse me. If the teacher is on bereavement leave, that's a different part of the contract. And if the teacher's on a personal day, that's another part. And if the teacher's on doing work for the district, at the district office or at the Department of Education or whatever, that's still yet another reason for the teacher to be gone that you want to be able to track, because, you know, you've got to track those sick days and those bereavement days and those any other reason why they're gone sort of days, so that you know where keep everybody in the right place. And so I'm just extremely concerned about districts that, you know, that both of you sort of related, that aren't necessarily keeping track of that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you and I had that conversation late Friday afternoon about substitute costs, and I asked some folks that, you know, responded. I called them back and I said, so tell me a little bit about how you work your substitute issues in your school districts. When you drill down on that question, they actually do keep that data. It's not part of the database initiative. It's part of what the school district does in its budgeting model.
Right.
And so, like, when I asked that question to Tillamook, they said they had $13,000 a year budgeted for substitutes for issues dealing with assessment and development of SimCam.
Okay.
And they said what they do is they get a slip, because the teacher who's requesting a sub or needs a sub fills out a slip, and this is pretty standard practice.
It is.
In all districts. And the reason why, it may be family bereavement, it may be sick, it may be personal day, but if they need a sub to come in for in service, they put that down. And districts do track that. Again, it's how you ask the question, because I don't believe the database initiative would reflect that. And you have to remember, as I ask these questions of staff, when you ask me to go out and get this, I don't have a problem doing that, but we're taking them away from their core function to get that data. So some of them say, it's going to take me a little bit, can I get back to you?
And
that's just going to take a while to gather that data and get to you.
And I recognize that it was on somewhat short notice. I think our letter went out like the 4th of February, and we were asking for an 11th of February response. So that's only a week. That's pretty quick turnaround for some of the data that we were asking for, and I understand that. So if they can, and as you get that in, Jim, if you would let us know, I'd greatly appreciate it.
You bet.
Great, thank you. Before are there any other questions for either Jim or Chuck? Okay, thank you. Before we adjourn, I'm going to ask Rob. Good old what's his name? Kramer, to come up, and then because I does somebody owe me money for the pig? Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, an acronym was used, huh? AOI or something?
Oh.
It's Associated Oregon Industries, for those of you that are wanting to know. But Rob, I'd like you to just kind of, and I'm not trying to, members, I'm not trying to set up a debate here. We would take a different strategy for that if that's what we were trying to do. But what I'd like to do, Rob, is kind of invite you to, because I know you've looked at this very closely with regards to cost structures, with regards to performance measures, and that's what this committee is really interested in. And there is a relationship between those things and the policy of whether or not, you know, whether or not we're using the right kinds of tools for assessments. We know one thing: assessments are here to stay because of No Child Left Behind. And I don't see that going away anytime soon. But it seems to me that there's got to be kind of a little bit of a smarter way to do this. And I do know, and I do applaud the fact that the department is looking at putting out RFPs. And I didn't mention that when Mr. Costin and Dr. Knorr were up here, but that they are looking at RFPs for some kind of what you might call COTS or commercial off the shelf types of assessments. But I just wonder what kind of response you might have to some of the things that I think we're kind of finding here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Chair Flores, thanks very much for having me up here. I'm Rob Kramer. I'm the president of the Oregon Education Coalition. And yes, I have looked into this issue extensively over the last several years. And I first want to thank the committee for taking this topic up, because I think it's vitally important that we ask the question now, 14 years into the implementation of the Oregon Educational Act of the 21st Century, has this improved our schools? I mean, that really is the central question, and it's a very, very valid question. 14 years in, we can say specifically at the high school level, have our high schools gotten better as a result of this act? That question is valid, and it's vital, and I think we have some data to actually shed a little bit of light on that. A couple of things that do that. Number one, Oregon's SAT scores. You talked a little bit about this earlier, and I want to expand upon that just a little bit. Since 1994, about the last 10 years, since basically the SIM has been implemented in Oregon's high schools, national SAT scores on the math test have gone up 12% or 12 points on average. Oregon's math test SAT has gone up 6 points. On the English test, since 1994, national scores have gone up 4 points, and Oregon scores have gone up 2 points. Now, I would think that's very, very concerning if we are thinking that we have improved our high schools with this act, and yet since it's been implemented, we are actually coming closer and closer to the national average on our SAT scores. At this rate, in 15 years, Oregon will be at the national average from a position in 1994 where we were well above the national average. I think that is indication number one. Maybe the SIM and the implementation of the SIM has not improved our high schools. Number two, all the rhetoric around this educational act said we'll have world-class standards by the year 2000. Well, we know, and it was revealed about a month ago, that actually Oregon's graduation requirements are among the nation's lowest, with 22 credits required for graduation. Now, I ask, how can it be that if we're pretending we have world-class standards, that our graduation requirements are very, very low? I would suggest to this committee that actually part of what's going on is all of the chase for the SIM portfolio items and the SIM testing is crowding out what students would otherwise do, and that's pursuing higher level classes, either AP classes or the third and fourth year of math classes, which are currently not required under Oregon's graduation requirements. A study that was released 2 years ago by the Oregon University System said that the SIM is a better predictor of first-year college success than the SAT scores. And that was actually quite heralded as, wow, look at this. We have developed an instrument that's even better than the SAT at predicting first-year college success. I did something that almost apparently nobody, including the Oregonian reporter who reported on this, actually did, and that was read the study. The study did indeed show that gaining a SIM was correlated with first-year college GPA and a little higher than SAT. But guess what the study went on to show is that a better predictor of first-year college success was high school GPA. So the SIM was a worse predictor of first-year college success than the measure that we have had since time immemorial, high school GPA. And it seems to me that's kind of a relevant fact that was left out of all the discussion. What we had before the SIM and what we still have after the SIM is a better predictor of first-year GPA in college than the SIM is itself. So I don't think that's much of an indication that the SIM is actually of value. This question of cost is also an important one, and I think when you heard from COSA, $2 right there, when you heard from the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators and the Oregon School Boards Association was essentially, we don't know how much this is costing our school districts. We have a pretty good handle on what it's costing the Oregon Department of Education because of the efforts of Mr. Costi, and I think we have a good handle on that. But it is almost impossible to determine what our school districts are actually forced to spend to implement SIM, CAM, and the assessment system. Costs that are not captured are costs such as, in the committee hearings last Thursday, we heard from North Clackamas High School students that said the entire school district and the high schools took 2 days for any student that has not yet achieved the North Clackamas SIM. Everybody who had achieved the SIM stayed home. Everybody else who hadn't done all of the portfolio samples and other things required for the North Clackamas SIM stayed there and tried to fulfill those requirements, an entire school district. Now, that cost will not be captured by any database initiative or anybody else, but I would suggest that that is a monumental cost if a school district the size of North Clackamas is taking its high schools and having them take 2 entire days simply for pursuit of North Clackamas SIM. We need, I think, to somehow get a handle on how much of those costs actually are being incurred by our school districts, and then use that for whatever cost-benefit analysis that we end up doing. Because if we cannot really honestly calculate what the school district costs are, if we throw up our hands and say, we just don't know, it's too embedded in what our high schools are doing at this point, how can we actually make a cost-benefit decision? It's impossible to do so. I would submit that if we say we can't determine what the cost is on the school districts, we have to then say there is no possible way to make a judgment of whether these are worth it. Moving on to the CAM, just briefly I'd like to talk about what is down the road for Oregon's high schools surrounding the CAM. I would suggest that Dr. Neuer get to this committee the current CAM design or CAM program guide. It's a 66-page document that lays out what is in store for our high schools if and when the CAM is actually implemented. Because we have had historic problems with our math problem-solving assessments and our other performance assessments. We know that. And there's a big question as to validity and reliability of this style of assessing. We know we have these problems. What the CAM will do is put perhaps as many as 24 additional performance assessments into our high schools for the pursuit of a CAM. Each of them are rubric scored, just like the current math performance assessments are in the 5th and 8th and 10th grade, and each of with the attendant costs of how to train teachers to actually do these types of assessments. And a whole portion of these assessments are going to be district designed, and some other ones will be designed by the Oregon Department of Education. And so if we have a question about whether the performance assessments are valid and reliable at the 5th, 8th, and 10th grade, we better then ask that same question about what's in store for the CAM when we put, you know, perhaps as many as 24 additional performance assessments into our high schools. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Freeman? Thank you. Peter, would you be interested in getting a copy of the CAM design document from Dr. Neuer? Dr. Neuer, can you make that happen?
We'll be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. I would appreciate that. And then at some point in the future, if we do want to delve into that, members, we would have the background material to do that. But I think Mr. Kramer does raise a good point. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate your input and your interest in this. Yes, you feel free to pay the pig on your way out. And since there is no other business before us, we will stand adjourned until Thursday, right? Today's Tuesday?
Right.
Okay, we will stand adjourned until Thursday. Thank you.